From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, there's too much plutonium at Pantex near Amarillo. What are the dangers? And during the Great Depression, there was a mass deportation of Mexicans from Texas. How was that story told in the newspapers at the time? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Pantex plant is a United States Department of Energy facility in the Texas Panhandle. It's the primary location for the building, maintenance, and disassembly of nuclear bombs in America. Pantex sits on 16,000 acres, 17 miles northeast of Amarillo. It is a major national security site, and the plant is tightly secured and strictly controlled. But a report from the Reuters News Service tells the story of what's at risk with the vast amount of plutonium stored at Pantex and why terrorists would want to get some of it. Reuters staff journalist Scott J. Paltrow wrote the story, America's Nuclear Headache, Old Plutonium with Nowhere to Go.
The U.S. and Russia have enormous amounts of surplus plutonium, which was used to set off atomic bombs, beginning with the Nagasaki bomb. And we have to find a way of disposing of all this surplus plutonium. We had, at the maximum in the 1960s, 37,000 bombs and warheads. And in the 70s, Russia had about 45,000. So that leaves a hell of a lot of plutonium over, particularly since there have been treaties requiring enormous reductions in the number of warheads.
So plutonium is really the missing ingredient for someone trying to build a nuclear bomb. The technology, the construction, building the bomb in and of itself is not that difficult. College students can do it, but you just need the plutonium to really have that fuel, right?
Relatively crude bombs can be built, but plutonium is somewhat more difficult to build a bomb from than uranium. The problem with uranium is that it's much heavier to carry than plutonium. Plutonium pits, as they're called, the part that actually explodes, have to be shaped in a certain way, and conventional explosives have to be put around it precisely. But we're finding from CIA reports that terrorist groups are developing technology and that they may well have the facility to do something like that.
To create their own plutonium, or to
create their own bombs. They need to steal the plutonium, and that's the big issue about why we need to do something with it to make it inaccessible and to turn it into a form that's not usable for bombs.
So we have to secure it away from terrorists who want to get their hands on it, and then we have to put it in a place where people are not around it, so with there's a leak of something, then we're not exposing people to radiation poisoning.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the small problems with plutonium is that it has a radioactive half-life of more than 24,000 years. So it's going to remain dangerous for a very, very long time.
So at Pantex in Amarillo, that is a special place where there's a lot of plutonium being handled. And in your article, you say that one slip of the hand could mean disaster. What kind of disaster are you talking about?
Well, the biggest danger, actually, is in order to set off plutonium for an atomic explosion, it has to be surrounded by conventional explosives. And if you're at Pantex, they remove the plutonium from the warheads. And in doing so, they have to remove those conventional explosives. And doing that can be a very difficult job. And in older weapons there, they're just glued on, which makes it more difficult. The danger, it's unlikely that there would be a nuclear explosion, although, I mean, the Department of Energy, which controls all of it, denies it, but some people say there is a very small chance. But there's also a danger of what's called a criticality accident, in which large amounts of radioactivity are released and can kill everyone in the room, basically. And also, if anyone in it, it's not dangerous if it hits your skin or the outside of you, but if you inhale any particles of plutonium, it's basically deadly. It'll cause all sorts of cancers.
So in 2005, the Project on Government Oversight claimed that Pantex workers could have caused a nuclear explosion when they improperly applied too much pressure on an obsolete W56 warhead while dismantling it. So, you know, a slip of the hand could mean disaster. You're talking about a mushroom cloud?
Well, as I said, all of this is controlled and handled by the Department of Energy, and they insist that there is zero chance of it. There may be a very minuscule chance that that could happen. No one really knows, which is why, you know, there's cause for concern and monitoring it closely. But I mean, as I say, the greatest danger is not from a nuclear explosion, but from, you know, a release of radioactivity that could kill everyone along the production line there, or release, you know, into the general atmosphere where residents of Amarillo and nearby areas would be breathing in deadly particles of plutonium.
How many tons of plutonium are at Pantex near Amarillo?
I actually don't know. All I know is that we have a total, the U.S. has a total of 54 metric tons of what it calls surplus plutonium. We actually have more than that, which we're keeping in reserve for weapons. How much of it is actually at Pantex, I don't know. I do know that they keep, at Pantex, they keep the what's called the PETs, the actual plutonium warhead parts, intact and store them. The maximum limit set by the Energy Department was 20,000, and they've now exceeded that. And the problem is that so far they have no idea what to do with them.
So they have these PETs where they put the plutonium in while it's not in a weapon, and they have a certain number of pits they can use, and they have gone over that amount. They have way too much.
Right. Well, they're not intended to be used. They're intended to be disposed of permanently so that they can't be used. But so far, there are no facilities that have been built that can take them. And so they're basically just being left there indefinitely, even though that never was the intention.
So Pantex is out near Amarillo, and it's not a major metropolitan area. You don't have a lot of newspaper oversight or media oversight or anything about what's really going on out there. Earlier this month, they did open a brand new facility out there, a 300,000 square foot building that was going to redo their offices and all this other great stuff over at Pantex. But that's like the first time people have laid eyes on what's going on out there in quite a long time.
Right. Well, Pantex, of all of the nuclear materials facilities that the Energy Department runs, and there are a bunch of them all over the country, Pantex is by far the most secure. And the reason for that is that it's the only location where they actually remove the plutonium from warheads and bombs, and it's also the only location where they put them into new weapons. So it's in many ways the most dangerous place, and so they try to keep everything out of public view and keep it inaccessible to thieves like terrorists.
Scott J. Paltrow is a staff journalist at the Reuters News Service. He wrote the special report, America's Nuclear Headache, Old Plutonium with Nowhere to Go. This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. In the 1930s, the Great Depression hit America and unemployment soared to 25%, and about 500,000 Mexican nationals and Mexican Americans were deported in order to preserve the jobs for Anglo-Americans. The story is told in the book, They Came to Toil, Newspaper Representations of Mexican and Immigrants in the Great Depression. It's written by Melita M. Garza. And she says, even though today's economy is strong, there are many similarities with what's happening today.
They were living in a world of disposable labor, much like today, and that is to say that they were viewed as disposable labor, not that they were in fact disposable labor. So with so few jobs available, so many jobless, the prevailing government officials decided that in order to create more jobs for Americans, they needed to, and implicit in that idea is that the people that were being deported were not American. So that's another issue and that's discussed in the book, but that these people were in the way of recovery and progress. So that's very resonant with many of the things that we've heard today. The irony of this, of course, is that these were people that had been building up our country and have a history of doing so, and suddenly were determined not to be needed.
So in the Great Depression, economic collapse, we had this abundance of labor. We had too many people seeking too few jobs. And one solution that some people came up with was get rid of certain populations of folks. And even if you were an American citizen, if you'd been born in the United States or had become naturalized, then you still had to go. If you were of Mexican descent, they were able to deport people like that.
There were several things that were going on at this time that are particularly important for Mexicans and Mexican-Americans. And that is to say that the states and local governments in many places throughout the country, not just in the South and the West, but also in places like Detroit and other cities, got together and decided that they were going to help remove the Mexicans who had suddenly lost their jobs. Of course, many of these people, as we've seen today, had U.S.-born children and had been living in the United States for many years. And so what happened was that these local fraternal organizations, they would be similar to our Red Cross today and other groups, got together with city and county officials to repatriate. That was a particular term using the assistance of the Mexican Consul Generals to put people on trains or help sponsor them back to the Mexican border, however they could. So this created a huge humanitarian crisis in Mexico, which of course was already, as you noted, undergoing this the depression as well, since it was global. And so people were amassing at the border and coming down the highways in caravans and on foot and on horseback and in carts. And remember, this is a time when the interstate highway system, so traveling, even if you were fortunate enough to have a vehicle, was very perilous. Tires didn't last very long. So this is a tremendous dispersion of humanity. And this was happening at a time when there was tremendous rhetoric in Washington about immigrants creating problems, crime, murder, drugs. So many of the themes that we've heard from some quarters of Washington today were actually the huge topic of discussion at the time and the basis for a lot of proposed legislation of various kinds to particularly eliminate people from the South America, the south of the border, which had never been done before up to that point. So in 1929, there's this confluence of things happening. There's not just the stock market crash. There's all this volatility in Congress with heated legislation and debates about immigration. For the first time, it became illegal to cross the border. Before that, it had not been. So suddenly, this is a whole change in the way people lived, and so this created another problem. But for the particular issue for my research in my book is that it looks at how this debate is centered in three competing daily newspapers in a city that is pivotal to the development of Mexican American identity in the United States. So when you think about San Antonio, Texas, people say, oh, yes, you know, important city in Texas, important city for the Spanish colonial empire, and they may be aware of all of that. But the additional point of this is that San Antonio had long been considered a border city, even though it was 150 miles from the border.
So essentially we had, like, what, refugee camps on the border with Mexico, with people who were being disposed of, deported?
So what was happening with the repatriation movement, which the Mexican government sponsored, and initially this was framed as as a fantastic thing for Mexico, which was trying to rebuild. And they said, okay, we will accept our brethren who have been living in the United States, gaining this important know-how and agricultural knowledge and accumulating a certain amount of wealth. And we'll welcome you back to Mexico where you can contribute and help build up our country. Part of this program was encouraged at the behest of the U.S. government that was saying, hey, Mexico, do something to help remove your people from our country because they're no longer needed. And so what happened was that so many of these people were coming back, and on top of this, through the repatriation program, there was also regular deportations where people were apprehended because they couldn't produce the documents that were suddenly essential. As I mentioned, in 1929, suddenly you had to have this. Before that, you didn't have to have these papers to prove that you could be in the country. Many people were being deported through other channels, rounded up by the Texas Rangers. So trains and were just jammed, special repatriation trains and deportation trains were literally jammed with these, in some cases, more than 1,000 people at a time coming down a train track. A number of them went through San Antonio, but through all other parts of the country and different border points. And so the problem became for Mexico was that there was a massive amount of humanity that was being essentially dumped at the border. And eventually the Mexico began sending the trains further into the interior of Mexico and leaving people there. But many of the border towns were completely overrun. The citizens tried to help, rounded up donations and food. People were given some assistance by institutions like the Catholic Church, but some of these towns almost went bankrupt trying to help assimilate the Mexicans that were being forced, in many cases forced to return, or if not forced, just strongly encouraged.
But also, as you point out, documents were not easily available to many people, even people who were born in the United States of all stripes, because many people were born at home. They didn't go to hospitals for their birthing experience. And a lot of people didn't have birth certificates or anything to prove who they were. So there probably were native-born Mexican-American folk who were rounded up and deported.
So that's exactly right. The new law suddenly made people required to come up with things like birth certificates, well, especially birth certificates. And at this time in our nation's history, very few people, or not many people, had birth certificates. In fact, local newspapers would publish things like, you really need to get these birth certificates. And these were not addressed to their Spanish language readers or citizens in their locales. They were speaking to English language citizens who just simply often didn't bother to get these documents because they were born at home, or the doctor never filed it, or what have you. So it was never so essential to prove that you were U.S. born until 1929.
People were making this determination then about who got to stay and who got to go, basically based upon how you looked and how you spoke.
Right, that despite how you looked and how you spoke, you might actually be a U.S. citizen.
If you were a Caucasian and you spoke English, but you didn't have any papers, you weren't deported, right?
Well, I have no evidence that happened. There may have been some who were, but unlikely. Just as today, you're more likely not to be targeted if you come from an English-speaking country and you look the prototypical American or the socially constructed American, which is not, quote-unquote, Mexican-looking or brown or what have you. So there was a particular target population, just as today there's a particular target population.
So the question is then about how was this reported? How did people learn about this? Was this being put in the newspapers, or which newspapers, and in what way? And this is where we get into really the strong action line in your book, They Came to Toil, newspaper representations of Mexicans and immigrants in the Great Depression. So the newspapers were telling people what?
In San Antonio, there are three daily newspapers, two English language and one Spanish language. the Spanish language newspaper La Prensa nationally, actually transnationally circulated almost in every state in the country and in Mexico. And then also the Hearst-owned, William Randolph Hearst-owned San Antonio Light, and then the independently owned San Antonio Express. And each of these reflected perhaps the ideas of their owners and publishers. So the Express, which very much represented the banking, ranching, and railroad interest, and had a keen understanding of the importance of Mexicans to the development of the Southwest economy and to the United States economy, repeatedly ran editorials that called out legislators who were pursuing anti-immigration laws, denouncing efforts to remove Mexicans, very forward-thinking in terms of just the role and importance of Mexicans to the economy. And also they used other arguments. They talked about the importance of having a good relationship with Mexico and our southern neighbors and diplomatic interests and ideas, they said, in particular, that Washington perhaps does not understand because they're too far removed from the reality of the Southwest border. So that was one point of view. And then the Hearst-owned paper ran generally canned, I call them canned editorials, that were often penned by William Randolph Hearst, or it reflected his perspective that that immigrants should be removed, that only the quote unquote the fittest, only the best. Perhaps you've heard our current president talk about following the Canadian model of immigration. Well, William Randolph Hearst also was espousing that long before. Canada picks only the best. We should be picking only the best. And repeating a lot of these eugenics or white supremacist arguments about immigrants from other countries being mongrels, being vermin, being just dehumanizing the immigrant who did not appear in the image of the typical Mayflower immigrant. So that was a virulently anti-immigrant editorial page. And then, of course, the immigrant founded and owned La Prensa, founded by Ignacio Lozano in 1913 in San Antonio. And initially, the editorials in La Prensa were very keen on the Mexican government's repatriation program, calling it a noble calling. It would be wonderful if the Mexicans could return to Mexico and rebuild the country. But as time went on, they realized that Mexico really wasn't up to assimilating the its former citizens, and urged people not to go if at all possible. And so the La Prensa became this incredible voice for Mexicans and Mexican Americans throughout the country. And then later in 1926, it founded the La Opinión in Los Angeles, which still exists today and still publishes today.
The newspapers at the time, not that different than having cable TV watching Fox News versus watching CNN. You're going to get a different flavor and a different framing of events based upon what the editorial viewpoint is on certain things. And you talk about that in your book. You have, there was a Rotary Club luncheon on January 10th, 1930, where they have a William K. Knox, a San Antonio Public School assistant superintendent, addresses the Rotary Club, and he talks about a recent economic study that showed that Mexican cotton pickers earned $11 million a year, and they came back to San Antonio, and they would spend that money here. And he was talking about how beneficial these Mexican workers were to the local economy. This was something that was covered in La Prensa. The Express also covered it, but the Hearst paper failed to even cover the speech. So you were getting a different viewpoint based upon what you read, right?
Right. So the different newspapers covered different things, and the Rotary Club speech of the school vice superintendent Knox was one example, and the study that he conducted that showed how pivotal Mexicans were to the economic survival of San Antonio was one of these issues. And beyond that, he also talked about the rich culture and history that Mexicans and Mexican Americans had in San Antonio. La Prensa vigorously covered this removal and this almost biblical exodus of Mexicans and Mexican Americans, and not only up to the border but across the border. And for the other two papers, it was much more of a policy issue. Almost very little coverage in the Light. For the Express, it was largely a policy issue and told from the perspective of the ranchers and the growers, which makes sense given their imagined community of readers. But these were still people, and they were viewed as disposable labor. And once they were removed, you really didn't hear anything about what happened to them in the Express. It was like they disappeared into thin air. So the socially constructed reality, the differences between these three papers is enormous. And if you read the Light, you probably wouldn't even know that these people were being dismissed on such large scales.
It seemed like that newspapers were a constant reinfector of the population for racist ideas. Have they ever done anything to sort of like rectify or even try to identify that they did this?
I think the entire news industry needs to do much more than it's been doing. I mean, we know that we just had the anniversary of the Kerner Commission report, the report that was instituted after the race riots in the 1960s, and part of that report, as you know, called for greater inclusion in newspapers. And actually, it was nothing new. It had been called for in earlier reports. As this country becomes increasingly diverse, and look, we have this, just to get it back to San Antonio, for example, a city that is majority Hispanic and majority Mexican American. The second largest, or one of the two largest Spanish-dominant cities in the United States, metropolitan areas, and so no, is there enough? No, there hasn't been enough done, and there needs to be a lot more done. A couple of crucial takeaways for the news consumer: one is to understand that the arguments and debates that they're hearing today are nothing new, and that all they need to do is go back and look at newspaper coverage and see many of these same positions and ideas and attitudes presented. And the second one is that we all need to be concerned about our news diet and how narrow it is. But I think actually there's a third takeaway, and this one is a little bit more positive, which is to say that if this kind of exodus that happened in the predominantly in the early 1930s had happened today, we would have seen a lot more coverage. It would have been very difficult for a newspaper to ignore this. On the other hand, we still have to deal with the issue of whose voice gets heard, what angles of this story are covered and which are not covered. And the only way you can try to get a full picture is to expand your news diet beyond simply one source.
Melita M. Garza is a professor of media studies at TCU's Bob Schieffer College of Communications. She wrote, "They Came to Toil, Newspaper Representations of Mexicans and Immigrants in the Great Depression." It's published by the University of Texas Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.